Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for October's Orthopaedics Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce our speaker for today, European and RCVS specialist in small animal surgery, Richard Meeson. Thank you, Richard. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Hello everyone, welcome to today's webinar on the principles of internal fixation. So we've been fixing fractures for many years, the Egyptians, the Greeks, we're using plaster of Paris and external fixation. And then we moved on to immobilization with traction and external captation, sorry. So this has been going on for quite a long time, but the problem with this type of approach is you get muscle wastage, bed sores, cast sores, and you can get problems with fracture union and arthritis of joints because they're not being used very well. So in the just about before the 1950s, Robert Danis was a Belgian surgeon, and he developed this implant plate, which you can see here. And he fixed the fracture rigidly and it healed without forming any callus. So there wasn't lots of new bone formation around it, but the bone directly healed. And this sort of was the precursor to what's called the AO, or the Arbeitsgeheimnisse für Osteosynthetophrage, which basically was the bringing together of a group of human orthopedic surgeons in Davos. Fairly appropriate considering the type of injuries you get when you do this sort of stuff. And they developed a set of principles for fixing fractures internally. Also, this is known as the Association for the Study of Internal Fixation. Often people refer to the ASIF principles. And they linked education, research and training, and this was really the birth of internal fixation in the late 50s. And their principles were to have anatomical reduction, so putting the fractures back almost like a jigsaw puzzle, to stabilize them with internal fixation, to look after the blood supply, and then to get back to early pain-free and safe mobilization. And these principles are still important today, although we've sort of switched a little bit to what's called biological osteosynthesis, where we don't necessarily put the fracture together totally anatomically. We may use a less rigid fixation to allow more callus healing. And we're more concerned about maintaining good blood supply, so we don't disturb the soft tissues as much. And AO Vet came not long after the original AO was set up, so about 11 years later in the late 60s. And actually, one of the human surgeons repaired his wife's dog's fractured leg with this internal pin here, which went on to heal, as you can see the healed callus there. So there's been a quite a strong relationship between the veterinary side and the human side for many years with the AO. So bone healing can basically go through one of two processes. You can have indirect bone healing, which is the normal physiological process when we break a bone. You get a big sort of a blob of callus bone form, which forms quite rapidly, and you get a return of mechanical strength of the bone really quickly. Or there's this artificial system called direct bone healing, which is something that we have developed or we have created by internal fixation. So we stabilize the fractures really rigidly and then you get direct bone union. This is an artificial process that recapitulates bone remodeling. So callus healing, as I say, is the physiological way that bones heal. So what this usually means is that you've got a fairly big gap, so at least a millimeter, and that the fracture is relatively unstable. And you get the bone breaks, you get a blood clot, then you get invasion by inflammatory cells and then stem cells. You start to get granulation tissue, then you get cartilage form, and then the cartilage gets remodeled to bone. And this remodeling process can take quite a long time. So this big blob of disorganized bone gets reorganized into cortical bone over quite a long period of time. So as I said, it's an artificial process. We're tricking the bone into doing something called Haversian remodeling, which is the same thing that happens in our bones, that every 7 years or so that our bones have been totally replaced because they're always remodeling. And direct bone healing is subdivided into two types. We've got gap healing. So if there is a very small gap and a fairly stable fixation, then bone can be laid down from top to bottom, and then it gets remodeled by the cutting cones. So these are the osteoclasts moving across the bone to remodel it. And if we've got absolutely no gap at all, or under 0.01 millimeters and really no movement at all, then you get just direct remodeling of the bone with the cutting cones. Okay, so they're the two sort of bone repair types. So why does that matter? Well, it matters because what we do as a surgeon alters how the bone heals. So how well we reduce the fracture, how accurately we put the bone fragments back together will affect this. What type of fixation we use, so how rigidly we put the pieces of bone back together, how much metal work we used, if you will, and how we use it, and whether or not we compress the fracture. So compression is the act of squeezing the fracture fragments together, and this increases the reduction, so the fracture fragments have got less gaps, and it makes the bone more stable because as it squashes together, it provides stability and load sharing. So the classical plate and screw scenario, we would have anatomical reduction. So we put the fracture back together very carefully. We'll have compression, and then we have rigid fixation because we're using a plate and screws. And this tends to lead to direct bone union. But this is actually a much slower process than indirect bone union. So the kind of fractures that are amenable to this tend to be to direct bone union will be transverse fractures or oblique fractures. Some segmental fractures, fractures with very small amounts of comminution or articular fractures are generally amenable to primary bone union. So this has got a butterfly fragment in this fracture here, and then this has been reconstructed and stabilized with a plate. And here you go, this has then gone on to remodel with a very small amount of callus really, and mainly direct bone union has occurred here. Articular fractures are an instance whereby direct or primary bone union is what you really need. So fractures such as this fracture here in the trochlear groove, you see these fracture segments. These pieces have been squashed together, so we've got compression with the implants, and then we stabilize it. Or this lateral condylar fracture here, as you see on the radiograph. Here's the condylar fracture, and this has been stabilized with a screw, which has been applied as a lag screw to squash the fracture fragments together. The reduction is good, you can't see the gap, and there's no step, and then there's a secondary implant to keep it stable. So we want direct or primary bone union in articular fractures because we don't want lots of callus forming or gaps in articular surfaces. So historically, we try to achieve primary bone union in all fracture repairs, and as I said, now we've moved more to more of a biological approach, and it's not always necessary or essential. So this comminuted fracture here has been stabilized by a plate with some locking screws and some non-locking screws, and this segment in the middle hasn't been repaired, it's just been left, and as you see over time, it's just formed a nice big fracture callus, and this has probably healed quicker than it would have done if I had put these pieces all back together with lots of different screws and implants. So it's not always necessary, it's not always desirable to do reconstruction and direct fracture healing, except for articular fractures. So what are the considerations? So healing times, so how quickly these fractures heal will affect what you do in your post-op. So how soon you re-radiograph them, when you can take implants out, and how much exercise the animals do. And this is again, as we said, dictated by the type of fixation, which affects the type of healing and therefore the duration of healing. And also young animals will heal more rapidly than older animals. So you take this rough sort of schema here. So the young animals are always healing more rapidly than the mature animals. And if you've got direct union with a fracture repair with a plate, if you compare that to indirect fracture union where you use a fixator, the plate almost takes twice the length of time to get the same amount of healing. So often we're leaving plates and screws on for much longer. So in a mature animal, you're nearly getting to a year before you consider taking a plate off, where you may take a fixator off for about 3 months potentially. So it does have a factor on what happens. So the principles of internal fixation. So first thing you've got to do is understand your surgical approach because you need to look after the soft tissues. You need to know where the nerves are, where the blood vessels are, because if you damage those, then there's no point in fixing the fracture if the leg won't work. And it's important to do as minimal damage to those tissues as possible because they provide important blood supply. Next, you need to think about how you're going to actually reduce the fracture. And often this is just written in the textbook as just reduce the fracture, but in actual fact, it can be quite complicated piece of the surgery. So we tend to hang the limb first. This stretches out the fracture fragments and relaxes the muscles. This helps you get your fracture reduced. You can also use levers to actually lever the fracture fragments into position. You can use bone holding forceps to pull the piece of bone in out of alignment and then reduce it. You can use the fracture to your own advantage. So in this oblique fracture, putting a pair of forceps across the fracture will actually slide the fracture fragments away from each other and allow you to get the fracture correctly reduced. So a range of forceps and fracture reduction instruments are very useful. Points are useful. Ones with ratchets are a little bit more dangerous than ones with a spin lock because the ratchets you can go click, 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 and then you can click a bit too far and actually fracture the bone. So I tend to prefer to use a spin lock wherever possible, but it just depends on what you've got available. You can use a fixator to help you get your fracture reduced. So if you put a pin at the top of the fracture, pin at the bottom, and then you can use a fracture distractor such as this. So this has got a sort of a bolt type configuration. You can actually wind this down and distract the fracture fragments apart. Can be quite useful in old fractures where there's lots of muscle contraction. You can use an IM pin driven down the fracture to actually push the fracture fragments apart and allow the bone to align. And sometimes you may leave it in as a plate rod, or you may take it out again and just allow you to. It was just useful during the fracture reduction period. So such as here. So this tibial fracture has got a pin placed from the styrofoam down. This allows you to line up the fracture fragments and distract the fracture while you place your implants. So there are different types of implants used in internal fixation. So IM pins are intramedullary, so they're in the medulla. And the point about this is it means that they're fairly neutral to bending forces. So normally a bone has got a tension surface and a compression surface. And the closer to the middle of the bone you are, the less bending and compression that there is, the more neutral, or the more you move towards the neutral axis, to which makes the pin much stronger, basically. So a pin in the middle of the bone is much stronger than the pin on the outside of the bone, basically. So it works very well, but it's only really good for resisting bending forces. So there are virtually no instances where using an IM pin on its own is a good idea. A lot of the pins will have a trocar point like this, so you can actually drive them through the bone. And sometimes you may then cut the point, the tip of the point, you cut the tip off. To prevent it from penetrating the bottom of the joint. And here we've got one that's combined into an external skeletal fixator as a tied-in IM pin. So IM pins can be placed normal grade, which means you start at one end of the bone, traverse the fracture and come out at the other end, or you can start retrograde where you place it from the fracture site out and then back down again. In small animals, you tend to use a K wire. So that's a same sort of device, but under 2 millimeters is called a K wire. If they're bigger than 2 millimeters, then they're normally a Steinmann pin. So in this cat, this would have been a K wire rather than a Steinmann pin, but it's still acting as an intramedullary pin, basically. And here's a plate rod example. So we've got IM pin driven down the bone. This will help distract the fracture, helps keep everything aligned, and then the plate is also placed. So the plate resists torsion forces, re resists compression forces, resists tension forces, and the IM pin helps protect the plate against bending forces. So they work together very well. K wires, as we said, are the small pins that are under, they're 2 millimeters or under. So because they're quite small, they're quite weak to bending. But they may be appropriate in a small cat or something like that. But they're also very useful in surgery as a temporary stabilization or permanent stabilization device. So I quite often skewer bone fragments to hold them in place while we then would place a plate or screws or something like that. And it's useful if you cross them, then they can provide quite a lot of stability because they resist the bone fragments from moving around. So these are very useful. So I always have a wire box out in surgery, and I often put pins in fractures as I go along, and quite often I leave them, sometimes I remove them. Here's some examples. So in this instance, we've got the condylar fracture, which has been stabilized by this screw placed in the lag, but the K wire, sorry, is then acting to stop this fragment from rotating. Here's cross K wires from a Salter Harris type 1 distal femoral fracture. So the crossing stops the fracture from being able to twist or move. Here's a ilial fracture where there's a KY placed across a fracture fragment just to temporarily stabilize it while the plate goes in place. And here's a another condylar fracture plated from medial where there's a KY here, just was part of stabilizing this fracture fragment prior to putting the plate on. So they're very useful. Orthopedic wire can be used in multiple different ways. So you can use it as a cerclage wire. So when it's a cerclage wire, you're actually encircling the circumference of the bone. So for this to work, the bone has to be totally reconstructed. If you have an unreconstructed piece of bone, the wire just crushes all the fragments together. And actually, cerclage wire is, because it's cheap and readily available, it tends to be quite popular, but it's very difficult to actually do really well. So we tend to use it very rarely. Never use alone, and most commonly it may get used with an IM pin. You need to use at least two wires, and it's best where fractures are oblique and that the length of the ubiquity is at least twice the diameter of the bone, and then they tend to work reasonably well. But as I said, there's not normally better options, such as in this instance, you could put a lag screw across here and a plate, or a lag screw and a fixator, or something else. They can also be used as a tension band. So, tension band is very helpful and clever in orthopedics. So, in this olecranon fracture, the pull of the triceps is trying to yank this fragment off the back of the ulna. So, if we apply a pin and tension band construction, then it actually converts the forces pulling this up into a compressive force to actually squashes the fracture back into the correct position. So, we put small pins in to actually secure the fragment, and then the wire, the figure of eight tension band wire, converts the tension into compression. So we have something like this. So in this instance, there's also a lag screw because it was a two-part fracture. A couple of small pins here, and then the wire actually does the work and converts this tension force into a compressive force. So it makes so as is there's the triceps pulls, this fracture actually gets more stable. So it's really clever. Probably you'll be familiar with this being used in patella luxation surgery. So the tibial crest has been moved over. It's been secured with two KYs. And then the tension band wire, figure of eight, loops around at the bottom here, is actually what does the work. So as the quadriceps pulls this upwards, the actual fracture gets squashed towards the tibia. Screws. So they can be used to stabilize bone fragments, such as here in this sacroiliac luxation in the cat. So the wing of the ilion has been screwed to the sacrum. They can be used to provide compression, so that's very useful, or they can be used to attach a plate to the bone. And within certain types of plates, such as the dynamic compression plate, they can actually be used to apply compression to a fracture. So the different types of screws, so you can have partially threaded screws. Cancellous screws have got a much sort of broader threads on them, so they can grip the more spongy bone. Cortical screws tend to have more threads per unit area, so higher pitch, but the threads don't tend to be as deep as the cancellous screws. Most of the time, we use cortical screws for most things, and they come in different sizes, so 3.5, 2.7, 2, and there are other sizes, and the size relates to the diameter of the thread. And then you can get these charts, this is available online, so you know what size drill bit you need. So if you have a 2.7 screw, you use a 2 mm drill bit, and that relates to the core diameter, the central part of the screw, not the thread. You may have heard of interlocking nails. They're used very commonly in people. So if you fracture your femur, you may well get an interlocking nail. They can be done minimally invasively using fluoro, so you don't get much scarring. The problem we have with dogs and cats is that they're, well, certainly dogs, their bones tend to be more, they tend to have bigger deviations, more sigmoid, so they don't work quite as well, and we get more variation in size. And each interlocking nail comes with its own kit. So we apply this kit, and that tells you where to drill the holes to lock this intramedullary device. So they do work well, but you need a lot of kit to do this in veterinary orthopedics. So the principle, so compression. So what is it, and why do we do it? So compression maintains the fracture surfaces in apposition, so it keeps them together, and it does it by applying a force. And by when you do this, you increase the surface area of contact between the fracture fragments, so you've got smaller gaps, and then you've got more stability. So it tends to result in direct bone union. There are three methods. You can apply a screw that you use in applies a lag screw. So a lag screw isn't a particular type of screw, it's just how you use a screw. Or you can achieve it with the compression plating, where the screws plate in load in the plate, and we'll come back to that. Or, and it's not so good, but you can squash the and apply compression using instruments and then just maintain that compression by preventing them from springing open again with other implants such as pins and screws. So the lag screw. In the lag screw scenario, we have a glide hole, which is as the same size as the threads, so the threads don't engage in that part of the bone. And then we have a thread hole, which is smaller and then has got the threads in the bone. So as we tighten the screw, it pulls this segment of bone down towards the far segment. Whereas in a positional screw, which is shown over here, you've got threaded portion in both sides, so the screw tightens and doesn't actually allow this segment of the fracture to squash and compress onto this segment. So when we do this, we have our drill bit and our drill sleeve to protect the soft tissues. We drill a hole on the first side, and then we put the insert sleeve on, and then we drill the far side. Sometimes we have to countersink the bone a little bit to get the screw head to fit in. We then measure the depth of the screw that we need. We then tap the far piece of the bone, the transcortex, with a tap, so that makes threads in the bone, and then we place the screw, and that pulls this together. What's important when you place lag screws is that they are at 90 degrees to the fracture line. If they're not, you get this problem that they actually will displace the fracture. So you've got to be quite careful about how you orientate them. So conventional plating, we tend to use mainly cancellous screws, but you can cortical screws, but you can use cancellous screws, and the screw goes through a hole in the plate. And plates can either have oval holes, such as this dynamic compression plate, or they can have round holes like this. And you can also get anatomical plates, such as this acetabular fracture plate here. So the way that this works is that the screw head sits in the hole in the bone, and then the actual threads themselves engage in the bone. And as you tighten the screw, this is not locking into the plate, so it actually pulls the bone towards the plate or pulls the plate towards the bone. And then you get friction and compression between the undersurface of the plate and the top surface of the bone, as shown here with this schematic. So it pulls the two together as you tighten the screws. So the stability of the fracture is dependent upon friction between the underside of the plate and the bone. So therefore, the more screws you have, generally speaking, the better the or the more friction that you create, because you are squeezing the plate onto the bone with more force. The screws need to be tight to achieve this, and the plate needs to be what's called contoured correctly, so the plate actually fits the shape of the bone very accurately, because you want them in contact to create friction. A dynamic compression plate, which has been used since the 70s, is a very versatile plate. So this plate has oval holes, and the oval holes allow the screws to be put in eccentrically if you put them in load. So if the screw is placed at one side, the screw is almost a bit like a ball rolling down a slope. So as it does this, it actually forces the plate away, and that squashes the fracture together. So if you look at this steresis diagram here, so the brighter the color, the more strain or force there is. Here's the fracture line. As we tighten the plate together, tighten the screws in, they slide down the ramp and they squash the fracture fragments together. And you can see how this is creating quite high stresses. So this creates compression from within the plate. So this is appropriate if you've got transverse fractures like this, and they're simple. If it's an oblique fracture, it will actually slide the fracture fragments, which we don't want. So it needs to be a transverse fracture and needs to be reconstructed. And then if you apply a plate in compression, so if that's applying the plate with the screws in the compression mode, then you can actually you can call that compression plating. But as I say, it needs to have the DCP style oval hole to do this. And then we use a specific guide, which is called a load guide, to actually put the screw in the correct position. So here's a fairly classical example. Plate and the radius, transverse fracture, screws in here, tighten the screws onto the bone, and then some of them are placed in what's called load or compression, and that squashes the fracture together. The ulnar fracture hasn't been repaired. This is generally the case. You can also apply a plate as, rather than a compression plate, you can apply it as a neutralization plate. So these terms don't relate to what the plate type it is. You can still use a dynamic compression plate, but you don't put any of the screws in compression. So all the screws are placed in neutral. And what happens here is that you normally repair the fracture with some other means, such as lag screws, and then the plate's added on top to just to take the load away from this primary repair. And this is generally quite good for oblique fractures or butterfly fractures. So it's neutralizing some of the forces. And again, we've got what's called load sharing. So the plate and the bone are both taking the forces of walking, as is the case with this. When the plate's using compression, the bone's taking load and the plate's taking load. So these are very sort of safe, strong fixations. So here's a tibial fracture double spiral. So you can see the two spiral fractures crossing. And this fracture is therefore amenable to repair by lag screws to actually get these fracture fragments to be compressed. And then you place a plate as a neutralization plate, as I did here. So lag screws pull the fissures together, the spiral fracture together, and then the plate is applied to neutralize the force and protect those repairs. Then the final way is to apply the plate as a bridging or a buttress plate. We tend to use the term bridging a bit more commonly these days. So these tend to be comminuted fractures. So the bone itself isn't going to take any of the loading from walking. These are non-reconstructable. These potentially could be done with minimally invasive plate osteosynthesis, where you make two little holes and push the plate up along the bone and then secure it. There's no load sharing, so the plate's doing all the work. So this is at a higher risk of having implant failure potentially if you don't plan for that. So this is a bridging or a buttress fixation. And here's some examples. So bilateral tibial fractures, non-reconstructable. We've got plate fixation, medial aspect in both tibias. And these are basically the force goes down the leg and into the plate and then back out again. The same for this side as well. And these tend to then heal with a bit more of a biological means. So you tend to get more callus healing. Next principle is the number of screws is a consideration when you are placing plate and screws. So if you only have one screw in a fracture fragment, then the bone can rotate on that screw. So you need at least two to stop that happening. But if you get one fail, then the whole thing will become unstable again. So the recommendation is to place three screws. So three bicortical screws per fracture fragment, so six cortices. There isn't any significant advantage once you get beyond five bicortical screws per fracture fragment. So we tend to aim for something in that region. If you want to make the plate longer and span a bigger area, then you just simply leave out some of the other screws. You should apply plates to the tension surface of the bone. So unfortunately, no bones are totally like a column. In fact, always the forces act towards one side. This means that you then get what's called a tension surface where the bone source is being pulled apart and a compression surface where it's being squashed together. Bone plates are very resistant to being pulled apart, so they're very good on the tension surface. They're not very good on the compression surface. So wherever possible, if you have an intact bone, it's best to place the plate on the tension surface. So here's a scenario, you've got a fracture like this. If you place the fracture on the medial side, that's on the compression surface, so this is not very strong. If you place it on the lateral side with a reconstructed fracture, this is strong because this is now the side with the plate on is the tension surface, so the plate's good at being resisting tension. If you've got a non-reconstructed fracture, this doesn't apply because the bone will just collapse where there's no support here. Okay. So this means, generally speaking, in a reconstructed fracture, that the cranial and cranial medial surface of the radius are tension surfaces. On the humerus, it's cranial and lateral in the proximal half. When you get mid humerus and distal, then it's medial. Tibia is medial and cranial, and femur is lateral surface. And generally speaking, these are the surfaces which have the best access for surgical approaches. So this is generally quite helpful. So then we need to select our plate. So how do we choose what size plate we're going to use? So one of the biggest things to consider is the animal's weight. And you get these veterinary plate charts. And this was based on the results of many, many, many studies where they looked at animals having plates and screws and why they did or didn't fail. So you can pick a particular area, such as radius and ulna. You can go to the weight, and then it gives you a rough idea what plate size you should use. So it'd be a 3.5 LCP or DCP or something like that. There are, of course, other considerations when you then use that information. You may go, well, have they got an injury on another leg? Is this a bridging fixation, or is there going to be load sharing? Is it a young animal that will heal more quickly? Is it an older animal that can heal more slowly? Because often you're in a bit of a race against time between the implant failing and the bone healing. So you make all these sorts of considerations, but your starting point is the animal's weight and looking at a plate chart. Then you'll probably go and get an acetate or a digital image of the plate, or hold the plate up to your radiograph, and then work out, will you be able to get sufficient numbers of screws in a fracture fragment? And again, as I said, we want really to have three bicortical standard screws. Next principle is that the plate needs to be accurately contoured for standard plating, and to be honest, fairly well contoured for locking plating, because for standard plating, it's the friction between the underside of the plate and the bone that gives you the stability. So the plate therefore needs to match the shape of the bone. If it doesn't match it, as you tighten the screws, it may pull the fracture out of alignment. You'll have less friction, and you may get a failure of the fracture. So you can, most of the time, we tend to contour plates in surgery. But if you're less experienced with this, you can contour before surgery. So you can use the contralateral radiograph, or if you've got a suitable size cadaveric bone, you can take the plate, contour it beforehand, so you bend it to the correct shape, and then you can autoclave it, and then you may just have to make some minor tweaks during surgery. So this saves you intraoperative surgical time. Then you see, think about something called pre-stressing the plate. So what happens when you have a plate is you obviously contour it to match the shape of the bone. As you tighten the plate, tighten the screws, the bone pulls towards the plate, which can lead to the far cortex opening up if you haven't done what's called pre-stressing. And what that does is it then means you've got a small gap on the far side of the bone, so this is no longer a load sharing construct, and it increases the risk of the plate failing because you haven't got support from the bone here because you've got this little gap. So this may lead to early plate failure. So what you do is you contour the plate to match the bone, but at the area where the fracture is, you put a tiny bend in the plate so it sits slightly away from the fracture line, and therefore when you tighten the screws down, it'll actually squash the far cortex together. So this ensures that you get good compression. And this is most relevant when you've got a transverse fracture that you are applying screws in compression to squash the fracture together. To reduce the lever arm effect on the fracture fragments, the plate wants to be as long as possible, but with, obviously taking into consideration the implants you have and the soft tissue dissection, as you get further up the radius, there are quite a lot of muscle insertions up here, which become a bit of a problem. Really far at the distal end, you've got the extensors, and you don't want to affect their movement in the extensor fossa, the distal radius. But generally speaking, the longer the plate, the better. So don't put a little tiny short plate on the bone. And the other thing is, and certainly for the case of using a DCP, you don't want to leave any screw holes empty over the site of the fracture. Because where the screw holes are, there's basically less metal. So this is what's called a stress riser. So this is a point where the plate will likely fail. If you have to leave a screw hole open, it's best to leave a few open in a row next to each other, so it spreads that force over several screw holes rather than focusing them on just one screw hole. All screws must be tight, and you should actually go back and retighten them at the end of surgery because they often loosen off. There's a stress relaxation with metal and bone, so you tighten them and then they actually become slightly loose again. So you need to retighten them. All screws ideally should be bicortical. Only lag screws should cross the fracture line itself. Avoid leaving cortical defects. Plan the fracture carefully and work as quickly as you can, but don't rush because obviously surgical time and anesthesia time affect infection rates. So to understand the benefits of a locking plate, we sort of have to understand how a conventional plate works. So as I said, for the conventional plate, it's all about the friction between the plate and the bone. And the degree of friction is dictated by how well the plate is contoured to the bone and how tight the screws are, which is why you have to tighten the screws as tight as possible, but you don't want to strip them, okay? So the tighter they are, the more they pull the two things together. And the greater the force between the plate and the bone, the more resistance there is to this moving up and down. So the construct's then very stable. A second problem that can happen with, or second issue or thing to consider with standard plating is something called toggling. Now, what that means is that because the screw head sits in a round hole and doesn't actually engage in it, the screw head can, in theory, move within the screw hole, particularly if it loosens slightly. And this allows the plate to move up and down and tends to lead to increased stresses at the interface of the screw and the bone, and then you can get some, the screw hole can effectively become bigger, and then this whole thing starts to become unstable. And this is because the screw head is not fixed into the plate hole. So the screw thread to bone interface, so how well the screw thread fits into the bone, will affect this stability. So if you've got poor quality bone, then it's more likely that the screw threads can pull out of the bone, as in this instance. So in this instance, if the screws can rotate in the hole because they're not fixed, as the plate could be lifted off and the screws can actually pull out from the bone because they can change their orientation to stay in line with the screw hole, but you get loss of the bone at the interface of the screw thread. So this is another problem with conventional plating. So a locking system is a bit different. So this is a conventional plating here. So plate well adhered to the bone, and then the screws go through. And then the analogy is the external skeletal fixator, where you've got pins in the bone, and then you've got an external bar, and you've got a clamp. And the clamp connects the bar to the transcutaneous fixation pins. And a locking plate construct is very similar. So you've got the screw goes through the bone, and then the screw doesn't have to, the plate doesn't have to be directly on the bone, it can be slightly away, and then the screw head locks into the plate just like the external fixator clamp. So they're sort of analogous. And that's why sometimes we call this internal fixation. So you've got standard fixation, external fixation, and then what we call internal fixation, where the plate's been used entirely as an internal fixator, as a locking system. So in this situation, the screw head has some sort of mechanism that allows it to lock into the plate. So most commonly, there will be a screw head will have a thread on it, and then there will be a thread in the plate, and then the screw will actually engage in the bone by this thread, and then it normally has a different thread at a higher pitch that's designed so these two things can work in concert, that then screws down into the plate. And this creates what's called an angle stable construct because the screw head is locked, so the screw can't toggle, it can't move in the screw hole, in the plate hole. So most commonly they're threaded ones. However, there are different systems. So the one that I've used the most and is probably the best described is a synthesis system whereby the screw head has a thread. But there's also the fixing system where they use an insert bush, and this the head locks into this bushing via a Morse taper fit. Or veterinary instrumentation system is fairly similar to Synthes, so they've got threads in the head, as is Securos. Although there are some other Securos systems whereby the plate hole is actually made of softer metal, and the thread in the screw actually cuts its own thread into the plate, so it gives you a bit more angulation options, whereas these tend to be fixed angle, so the screw head goes in at one position and that's it. You can't angle the screws particularly or at all. And then you've got the OrthoMet system whereby the standard screw head actually press fits into these nodes here. And we'll come back to that later. So conventional plating, there are issues with reduction. So you can get a couple of things. So if the plate isn't contoured correctly to the bone, as you tighten the screws, it pulls the bone towards the plate and you get loss of reduction. So that's primary loss of reduction as you tighten the screws. So that's a problem you can have with conventional plating. And then also the conventional plating, as I said, because the screws can toggle and rotate in the conventional plate holes, this allows the movement here potentially if these screws aren't really tight, and then the fracture can also collapse because of that. If you have a locking system, however, as the screws go in, they don't pull the bone towards the plate. They simply engage the bone and engage the plate, so you get no translocation of the bone fragment at all. So if the plate is not perfectly aligned to the bone, it doesn't matter because it won't pull it out of alignment. So the plate contouring doesn't have to be quite as accurate as it used to with conventional plating. This doesn't mean you can have huge gaps. Ideally, you don't want anything more than about 3 millimeters, 2 to 3 millimeters. But it does take out some of the issues of having to accurately contour in all positions. The other problem with it is, though, that you may be putting this screw into thin air and you can't tell because it feels stable because the screw head is threading into the plate. So that's another consideration. Whereas if you place a standard screw into the bone and it's not gripping anything very well, you can tell because the screw effectively feels quite loose. Locking plates also prevent or are less likely to have secondary loss of reduction because the screws are locked into the plate at the angle they're placed. They can't toggle, so they can't move, so they can't allow this fracture fragment to change, so that can't be moved. There are also locking systems, such as so. The other thing about locking systems is that their failure does not depend on the torque of each individual screw. This means that you can have a monocortical screw because the screws are locked in the plate and then in the bone, and that's stable at 2 points. So monocortical screws are a much better option in locking systems, and you can also use them where you've got poor bone quality. So in humans, they're often used in osteoporotic situations. And the reason why is that you're not dependent upon, as with the conventional screws, the quality of the bone interacting with the screw thread. So in this situation, the screws can rotate, and you can actually, if you've got poor quality bone, it can pull out. Whereas in this situation, the plate can't move unless it actually cheese wires through all the bone in a massive segment like this, because you see the screws are locked at the angle of the plate. So being angle stable does avoid some of the potential failures of a standard plating fixation. The thing you have to remember, though, is that the resistance to bending with the locking system is dependent upon the screws. And it's dependent upon the screw diameter to the fourth power, or the radius to the fourth power. So a small increase in screw diameter significantly increases the resistance of the plate of the construct to failure. So the locking fixation, locking constructs tend to fail by the screw snapping rather than the plate bending or the screws pulling out the bone. So you lose one problem but gain a slightly different problem. As is shown in this image here. So you're not relying on frictional stability, you're only relying on the screws themselves to resist to bending to keep the construct stable. So what this means is if you've got more of a gap underneath the plate, then it's potentially better for the periosteal blood supply. So there's an argument that you may also get improved healing because you're not actually squashing this blood supply on the outside of the bone as well. And this is also useful if you want to do MIPO, so minimally invasive plate type fixation, whereby the plate is just slid underneath the soft tissues and locked top and bottom. You haven't got to contour it and actually see the bone in great detail at those levels because you just use the locking screws to stabilize the fragment. So there's some principles to using locking screws to think about. So if you have the screws very close to the fracture fragment, you create a more rigid fixation. If you space them further apart, which tends to be what you do with a MIPO, you then got a bigger working area of the plate. So the plate is being bent between the two innermost screws. So in this scenario, there's a longer working length because this gap is bigger compared to this one. So this is a more bendy, more elastic fixation. So you get more callus healing in that scenario. So they can, as I say, be very useful. So this comminuted distal humeral fracture, short bone fragments due to the spiral component, and this was repaired with bilateral a locking plate fixation here, which is very helpful. Here, this is a case that had a plate rod fixation on its own, which isn't a particularly appropriate way to fix it. sorry, a plate in a iron pin fixation on its own, which wasn't a particularly good way to do it. Because of the size of this pin, it wasn't possible to get implants past it to do a plate rod, and it's also the pin is far too long as well. So then this was stabilized with two plates as a locking internal fixator. So these are locking screws applied top and bottom, big comminuted segment in the middle, left to heel. So the main plating systems, as I say, are the Synthes locking compression plates, the LCP, and this is quite clever because these holes allow for both standard screws like the DCP and the locking screws, and this is the only system that does that at the moment. So when they developed this system, they developed specially designed locking screws. So these locking screws have got a bigger diameter. So standard 3/5 screw, such as here, has got a 2.5 millimeter diameter, whereas the locking one has got a 2.8 millimeter diameter. So the screws are different. So this is resistant, much more resistance to bending, because the radius is increased to the and is to the fourth power. So small increase in radius gives you big resistance to bending. And they are also self-tapping screws. They've got flutes for that as well. So they're a very well-designed screw. And then the plate has got what we call combi holes. So this allows you to put a standard screw in this end if you wanted to, or alternatively a locking screw in the far end. So you've got options at each screw hole. You can't place two screws in the same hole though. So the oval part, I'd say, is like the DCP. So you can potentially still do a compression plate type of scenario. Or you can use the locking screws and use it as an internal fixator, or you can do a hybrid fixation potentially. The underside of these plates are also scalloped, so they reduce the contact on the bone, so hopefully improve peristaltic blood supply, and they've got a more uniform bending modulus, so they're less likely to fail at the screw hole. A standard plate tend to have a focus, you know, they tend to bend more at where the screw hole is, whereas these ones tend to bend a little bit more evenly. So if you place a locking screw in them, that is fixed angle. So you've got to consider when you bend the plate and you put a locking screw in that this changes the position of the screw. So you have to plan ahead for this. So you have to consider what's going on. So that may put a screw into a joint or into a vise or something like that. So this may be a point where you want to put a conventional screw in so you can still put it level and yet allow the plate to have been contoured to the bone correctly. So you do have to do some planning ahead with these things. Or whereas the standard screw can be put at all different angles. TPLO is a good example of this. So we tend to use this type of plate fixation for a TPLO. So we've got our radial cut, stabilized by locking screws at the top, and then you've got a mixture of dynamic compression holes and combi holes here for compressing the osteotomy together. So this works very well. This is also an example of hybrid fixation where one half of the fracture is all locking and the other half is a combination. In this situation, the proximal fragment, so the screw, because the plate's bent here, the locking screw would have been up here, which we didn't want, so it's got a conventional screw and then a locking screw. And there are some rules when you use hybrid fixation, which is when you use a mixture of locking and non-locking screws in the same segment. So you need to make sure the plate is accurately contoured to the bone. And that the because if you are going to use conventional screws, the bone still has to have friction between the plate still has to have friction onto the bone. So you mustn't have gaps in those areas. And if you're having areas where you've got locking screws, then you can have a small gap, about 2 millimeters. You always place the standard screws first, so it actually squashes and lags the plate onto the bone, so it creates the friction, and then the locking screws go in after. If you place the locking screws first, then when you place your conventional screws, they won't be able to pull the plate down onto the bone correctly, so it won't work. So they're totally pointless. So it works really well to use this hybrid system, but you have to do it in the correct order. The other system we'll briefly talk about is the OrthoMed string of pearls. So it looks like a string of pearls. It's quite a clever name. This is different because it was developed specifically as a veterinary product, whereas the Synthes system was developed for human orthopedics, and it's got a very unique design. So you've got a series of spherical nodes joined by these internode cylinders, and OrthoMed supply this plate. And what's clever about it is you can contour the plate in three dimensions, so 6 degrees of freedom. So you can put twist, bend, and two orientations. So it's rather like a reconstruction plate. So very useful for difficult areas to work on, such as across the pelvis or across proximal humerus or in an arthrodesis or in the spine, distal humeral condyle. The only thing, a problem with them, or one of the problems though, is they are quite big plates. They stand quite proud if you haven't got much soft tissue coverage. Useful for spinal surgery. So there's the node, which has got a superficial larger hole. And the other thing about this system is it uses normal conventional screws. So your standard as if cortical screws can be used in this plate. So you just have to buy a few extra implants to use this. And basically, the standard thread, so there's no thread on the screw because it's a standard screw, it's the shank thread actually engages into the node. And then you tighten the screw and it locks in to the node, and that's the locking component, and then it goes onto the bone. And that's how it works. So you don't need lots of extra kit, and locking is achieved without using specifically designed screws. But they do say that you have to use good quality screws because if the tolerances don't match what their expectations are, then you may not get a very good press fit of the screw head into the node. So these plates are actually significantly stiffer and stronger than the DCP, and although bending and twisting them decreases their strength, they are still equivalent to an uncontoured DCP, standard DCP, but not the broad DCP. So they are a strong implant in terms of the actual plate's resistance to bending. It's a locking implant, and again, it preserves peripheral blood supply because this is not normally in contact with the or a high level of contact with the bone. However, as you're using standard screws, they've got the standard screw diameter, which means that they are more or le well, they're less resistant to bending than the purpose-designed locking screws, because their core diameter is smaller. So when people have seen failures with this system, it tends to be the screws have broken. So you probably need to consider adding or using more screws than you would have done under normal circumstances to overcome this. So you spread the load over more screws. So quite frequently, if you're going to use this, you may want to add a second plate or add more screws. So rather than you would have placed three screws, you probably want to place four or five, or you may want to place a second plate. And as I say, they have quite a high profile, so not so good in the distal limb or in small animals. And that's it. Do you have any questions at all? So I think it's just a quick question about whether or not which type of system would I recommend, and I think it depends on what your setup is at your practice. So if you are doing lots of fracture fixation with internal fixation, then I would probably go for a system like the Synthes system because it's very flexible. You can use it as a DCP, you can use it as a locking plate, you've got the combination system, but obviously the setup costs are greater. Whereas the String of Pearls plate gives you some options with having a lot less investment in equipment and using your standard fixation equipment, but gives you an opportunity to use a locking system as well. So I think it really depends on what your setup is. Thank you. Okay, so we've got some other questions here. Let's just get this a bit clearer. Don't you find you have to remove the AY wires you're leaving in there afterwards once the fracture healed and they loosen? Is this the K wires? It depends really. It depends really on where the fracture is. A lot of the time in complex condylar fractures, it's quite helpful to leave the K wires in, and normally we'll cut them quite short. And I haven't really had a problem with them backing out. It does depend on, to some extent, areas where you've got low amounts of soft tissue coverage. So pins in the distal tibia over the malleoli quite often, or over the tibial crest, are more often likely to be a problem. So I would take a judgment as to whether it's an area whereby I think there may be a problem with the pins potentially. And if I was expecting that, then and the fixation was sufficient, and then I'd remove them. So, but generally speaking, the more fixation generally isn't a bad thing, but it's certainly, I would agree with you, it certainly is a consideration that you can get problems with the pins. Normally, if the fracture is really well stabilized, then the pins shouldn't be moving around. Pins that back out tend more commonly tend to relate to quite a lot of motion at the fracture site, so that it's not a very stable fixation. But they are really useful when you're starting to reconstruct a fracture and just to hold things together and keep things aligned. I would definitely recommend using them, and even if you then want to take them out again, I think that's okay. There's another question about smaller dogs finding radial plating technically harder. Would LCP be an option? Okay, so small dogs, distal radial plating can be quite technical because often the fractures are quite short, so you're often dealing with using T plates, and actually using a locking fixation won't necessarily help you that much. Really, normally they want to be compressed, and if you get good compression of those fractures, then they normally go on and heal quite well, and actually the construct is fairly stable. The issue is that with the locking screws in the distal segment, that sometimes you want to angle them away from the edges of the bone, depending on where the T plate is and how much the distal radius flares. And sometimes you want to angle them into a bigger piece of bone or away from the joint because there's a concavity where the joint is. So if the plate ends up being really distal, then you probably would still want to place conventional screws to angle them away. So there are times when it is helpful, but the problem with the locking screws is that it limits where you can position the screws. So sometimes that becomes an issue. But the other thing to say about when you've got short distal fracture fragments is that having the if you can't fit three standard bicortical screws in, losing one standard screw and having one locking screw significantly increases the resistance to torsional forces. So if I was in a fracture fragment where it was a fairly short fragment and I could only get two screws in, I would place one as a locking screw, and one as a conventional screw, or both as locking, because that's a more stable fixation than having two conventional screws. So that definitely is helpful.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Richard for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.